facing everything. Accord and respond without laboring, and accomplish without hindrance. Everywhere turn around freely, not following conditions, not falling into classifications. Facing everything, let go and attain stability. Stay with that, just as that. Stay with this, just as this. That and this are mixed together with no discrimination as to their places. So it is said that the earth lifts up the mountain without knowing the mountain's stark steepness. A rock contains jade without knowing the jade's flawlessness. Accord and respond. Facing everything. I want to talk about great faith and great doubt, which unfold in the context of great determination. This great faith, this great faith is essentially only this: a willingness to entertain that the Buddhas and ancestors and all the teachers you've encountered are not just screwing with you. And as David said earlier, that maybe this has to do with me. This is great faith. This is different from belief. This is different from certainty. It is a determined willingness to entertain that the Dharma might actually be valuable to you, that the Dharma might actually be true. It's not true because it's the Dharma. It's the Dharma because over and over, for generations of generations and generations, people have verified that that is what's there when we really look. This is profoundly liberating. You don't need to know that. You don't need to believe that. Enacting, actualizing the truth that it may be so. And great doubt isn't skeptical doubt. No, I think that guy's kind of full of it. Great doubt is very active and is utterly essential. Great doubt, there is no dogma, no doctrine that you have to believe without questioning. Great doubt is an active exploration of what is this? An active exploration of bringing your experience to what you see in Dharma words, to what you see and speak in Dharma liturgy, to how you meet the difficulties and ups and downs and trials and travails of your life, of when you read Zen texts, of discerning for yourself. What is that? It's one of my favorite lines in one of the new pieces in this, in the Song of the Tao, the author of the piece, after going on for quite a number of stanzas, says, and this is not a lie to fool the world. All of the koans, all of the seeming incomprehensibleness, you know, which begins most dramatically, with form is exactly emptiness, emptiness exactly form. What? But this is complete, this is actually not a lie to fool the world. This isn't a riddle. This isn't a encoding. That is actually the most clear that sentiment can possibly be. And our task is to really hold ourselves to that and explore. How is that true? How can that be true? And this exploration is not in a ritualized, formal way, but a really deep questioning, a really deep bringing up the teachings of the Buddhas and ancestral teachers, bringing up the teachings that we encounter in the liturgy, bringing up the teachings that we encounter in liturgical texts, in classical texts, and asking ourselves, what does this have to do with me? How? Wow. And what does it mean? I can't see what this has to do with me. But really looking, really using these tools as ways to meet the world. And so now in Buddhism, in Zen, these are not revealed truths that have been handed down to us on a mountain, you know, that we take. These are human beings like ourselves, exactly like ourselves, trying to share with us what they have discerned in the hope that we might be able to make use of it. And this engagement needs to be a active questioning, an active exploring. So one of my day jobs is, as you may know, I'm a Dharma book editor. And this means that the text, these things that, so ordinarily we see a book and we think that, well, if it's in the book, that must be it, you know, that. But one of the great gifts of my job as a Dharma book editor is that texts are literally alive for me. And by literally, I mean figuratively, alive for me in a way that they are mutable. When I have a question about something, I can actually get that question answered. I can take it up with the author and sort that matter out. If something is not well expressed or seems potentially misleading, I can clarify it or ask for it to be clarified. And this is actually, and this doesn't mean that everything I encounter I agree with. So one of the things that has been so provocative to me about that job is that I work with authors from other traditions of Buddhism and other styles of expressions and skill in means with other sets of tools than the ones we use, and other traditions using similar tools but wielding them differently than the way they're wielded for us. And this is enormously provocative for me. And so a big part of my practice has been something to do with, so why are they doing that? And why am I doing this? Am I wrong? Are they wrong? And not being satisfied with, yes, you're wrong. Yes, they're wrong. But to be able to see what I am doing, see what I value in the Dharma, see what accords with what I have verified as personally useful in meeting this big mess of a human life and this big mess of a human mind, my particular big mess of a life and big mess of a mind, and seeing and being able to meet with difference without needing to make one right and the other wrong, or one wrong and the other right. Master Mumon, in one of his verses in the Gateless Gate, says, "If you judge right and wrong, you become a person of right and wrong." And so, how can we meet this stuff without making it a test of who's smarter, who's better, which lineage has the true essence of the Dharma, and which are degenerate fools? So. And the doubt, the great doubt that arises when I see something that is clearly useful and powerful in one portion of Buddhism, but which don't connect to, can't make use of. And the process of exploring that, what is going on here? What can I learn about that? What can I learn about me? What can I learn about this? What can I learn about Zen, about Boundless Way, about koans, about shikantaza, about breath, about self, and about other? This isn't casual for me. It is a place of great energy and often grief, fear. And this is great doubt. And one way that this arises in the Zen tradition. You may be surprised to learn we don't actually emphasize most of the teachings of this guy who you may have heard of called the Buddha. Shakyamuni Buddha. The teachings in the Pali Canon. If you were to read them, if you were to take one of the Nikayas, as each of the collections is called, and open it up to a piece, what you would find in there would be quite startlingly not like the Dharma you are used to hearing in the Zen tradition, any portion of the Zen tradition. There are pieces of it that we use. There's a way that we accord with all of it. But not directly. So one of the collections of the Buddha's teachings, in which he says, in which he lays out the rules for what it means to be a member of the Sangha, and included, we may have all optionally broken that tonight when we added onions to our salad. That's actually expressly prohibited. And so the teaching, the things that we study in Soto Zen, we intensely study Dogen. The things that we study in Rinzai Zen are the koans. And those are the things that we need to find our way into, find our way to be able to turn around freely in the middle of them, facing everything, and finding accord for ourselves with them. And And when we find teachings in other portions of Buddhism, even from that guy Shakyamuni, and we don't find accord, it's of utmost importance that we explore, why is that? And it isn't actually the case. So one metaphor for the traditions of Buddhism is they are all instructions to get from one place, one, say, city, to another city, from Boston to San Francisco. And there are many routes you can take, full of left turns and right turns as you get onto, you know, the highway, and you go over here and you go up here and then you do this. And you can go that way, or you can go a different set of directions going south and exploring. But if you just kind of randomly assort sections of left turn here with following one path from another path, you can't just bring together two map directions and pick and choose. But you can't expect to go where either one of the directions would take you on your own, on their own, by itself. That was much more muddled than I was going for. Work with me. Entertain the notion that maybe there was a grain of sense there, a little bit of faith. So. And part of discerning each of our spiritual home in a sangha, in a school, in a tradition, is what is the language that what is the styles of expression that resonate with our heart? They're actually all good, but perhaps not for us. So we really have to listen with the heart, meet these teachings with the heart, and see what resonates. And it's okay if they don't resonate. You may want to seek elsewhere. So Zen, Zen doesn't emphasize the Pali teachings of the Buddha so heavily. And Zen has this completely other body of literature, the Mahayana Sutras, also by the Buddha, although they came into being 500 years after his death. And these sutras aren't part of the path of practice of the people who follow the Pali Canon. Why? What are they teaching? What is the value of them? How can we accord with those? How can we accord with the discord, the seeming discord? How can we accord with the seeming discord of our current experience and what it seems the teachings and texts are saying? There is a very... So I tend to I tend to give heavy emphasis to desisting, to entrusting, to receiving in practice, and in Boundless Way we give very strong emphasis to the teaching that just this is it. It is actually all already here. There's nothing you need to add or take away. But this doesn't mean that there isn't something to do. There is this practice. There is this exploring and verifying for yourself, seeing what it is exploring this certainty that arises for you that says, no, it's not all here. This is actually not okay. I'm quite sure of that. And to really look at that certainty arising in the light of practice, in the light of Zazen, in the lights of faith and doubt. This is the practice. And this doesn't mean in any given moment on the cushion that you're doing any of that. Nor does it mean you're not. And the essence of Zazen is, as Steve has so clearly expressed, the price of admission is the willingness to be with whatever comes. And to, in the presence of whatever comes, explore it with our faith in the great faith in the Dharma and non-malfeasance of our teachers and Buddhas and ancestors. In the great doubt of, I so don't really see that. And in the great determination of, it actually matters a great deal. It's not just, I believe it's true, I don't really see it, but, you know, what the heck, I'm going to go out to a movie. The great determination is the urgent fire. It is the matter of life and death, not in a philosophical or general way, but in the life, your life and death, the lives and deaths of the people you encounter, love, lose. This is urgent. So, faith and doubt, Mahayana, Theravada, koan, shikantaza. With realization, all things are one family. Without realization, everything is separate and different. But here's the thing. Without realization, all things are still one family. And with realization, everything is separate and different. The moon and the clouds are the same. Mountains and valleys are different. All are blessed. All are blessed. Great faith and great doubt. Is this one? Is this two? So, please sit comfortably. And we invite you to come forth in Dharma dialogue. And this showing up in Dharma dialogue can also be an expression of great doubt. And it can also be a powerful practice of generosity in the service of everyone in the Zendo. By you coming forth with your urgency, your question, your clarity of great service to all of us here.
I have, in the last year or so, begun to write some short pieces about people in prior generations of my family. I'm an only child and an only grandchild, and if I don't write these things down, they're gone. And it's been a quite varied experience just to think about these people. Some of them I knew, some of them I didn't know, but I heard other people talk about them. But after I had written a good many of these, I realized that the theme of all of them was that what I had done was right. Whatever I had done in relation to these people was the right thing to do. And whatever they had done that didn't suit me was not the right thing. And it's been only very recently and with fear and trembling that I have been able to turn my gaze on certain episodes selected at random or who knows, and contemplate what might have been done differently. And I realized it was because actually I could not bear the idea that I might look at one of these things and realize that there was something else that I could have done that would have been better than what I actually did. I just couldn't go into that moment. And I still, you know, have one toe in there. But it has given me courage to do that, to practice and to be in wonderful sanghas and just to spend time turning these things over in the light of sin. And I know that if I had not come to where I am, I would never have been able to look at these things. It was just too frightening.
So beautifully expressed, you know, and another, and such a expression of courage. Another name for the price of admission is the eroding of our commitment to the delusive certainty that we're right. And this is our heart breaking, open. And you know, one of the greatest bait and switches of spiritual practice. We come to spiritual practice because we have some image of more powerful and impenetrable armor of serenity and rightness that we could have, and we want to strengthen our crappy armor. And the great bait and switch is, just as Susan has expressed, that we actually realize that we need to take off even that crappy armor. And we can let this stuff that we were so sure was unacceptable, we're so sure would utterly destroy us, that we can actually let that in and be undestroyed and be inclusive of that too. That is the reliable gift.
You know, I am so over urgency. It's like everything we come across, everything we're told at work, everything, you know, that we hear is all about urgency. Everybody's hair is on fire. This has to be done right now. If in trouble or in doubt, run in circles, scream and shout. It's like, I just can't deal with any more of everything that has to be done right now because it's so urgent.
Right.
So, naturally, it's a relief for me to be able to respond to the quieter parts of Zen, that everything is perfect here and now. So, will you speak to me a little about urgency?
Yeah. So, for you, a real urgent matter to transcend urgency.
Yeah. Or not.
Yeah, there's something very important there. So we can even dispense with urgency. What about worthwhile and valuable to you?
Yeah, I can do that, and I can even do immediacy. But urgency, I don't know. It's so oversold.
Right, and so this is the question. This is the challenge to find a way to accord your great doubt of this this urgency with what seems to be meant in the Dharma. You know, so when we read something you know, we may have a reaction to, and we may conclude, that is just totally stupid. That is stupid. What a terrible way to express it.
You ever get any manuscripts?
How many times did you need to submit your manuscript before I accepted it? We can think, man, that is just a terrible way to express it. There is nothing dharmic that I resonate with there. So the challenge is, what if you were to entertain that in fact the person saying that doesn't have his or her head wedged totally up his nether regions or so. And to be able to find, to accord with an expression of Dharma that isn't yours in a way that clarifies and harmoniously resonates. And that's the process we all need to be engaged in, not deciding whether we're for or against urgency. Great question, thank you.
I want to make a case for two different kinds of urgency, because I really resonated with the kind of urgency you're talking about, which is this day-to-day deadlines and everything has to get done now and come on. It's a very narrowing view of all the possible.
Plus, my issue is more urgent than your issue.
Well, right, there's the competition about urgency. But there is a kind of urgency in Zen. I think actually Josh is kind of embodying it tonight. That he's just not a mild-mannered guy. I don't know if you've noticed.
You should see me when I'm agitated.
This is not...
It's a chin chill. That's what you're getting right now.
But the urgency is that this other kind of urgency is that actually we don't know how long we have on the planet.
Yeah.
We have to decide what's important to us, and it's an urgent matter. So in that sense, if we just kind of go mild on that, we're missing something. And I just caution you to you can apply that kind of urgency to that, the kind of urgency you were talking about. And it's very clarifying. It's like, wow, I have to get this thing done by 5 o'clock because so-and-so said I had to do it. But what if I was going to die tomorrow? Would I really want to do that? Maybe it's more important to do something else. You know, and so to use the urgency, the fire of practice to clarify this kind of fake urgency. I think of what you're talking about, right? It's fake. It's like, come on. It's been imposed on you by others. But this other kind of urgency, it arises from deep within. It's a longing. It's a yearning. It's bodhicitta. It's the energy of practice. So if we align with that, that daily, modern, 21st century urgency just seems really silly.
And this urgency that Melissa has just explicated is not at all the same as impatience.
Right. It's actually trusting.
So, urgency is very, the line between urgency and anxiety is very thin for me. And because I am very sensitive to feeling a sense of imminence, of perishing. And you know, it's about, like you said, facing this is this. I have to face my, that sense of imminence that I have as this. And that's, sometimes that's just really all I can do. That's my urgent response, is to face it as it is. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about the difference between great doubt, and the self-doubt, which seems to have become so much of what I'm facing as just, look at that, look how much self-doubt, look how much, you know, sometimes I spend 12 more hours in bed. I don't do the things that I'm used to doing that confirm I'm okay. So, they're not the same. But again, it's easy for me to get confounded.
Well, you've actually expressed a great deal of clarity here. And you have really so vividly put your finger on what is so important to you personally and specifically about Dharma practice and about finding a way to accord the Dharma teachings with your experience and the arising of the phenomena of self-doubt, the arising of the phenomena of anxiety, of dread. And you have clearly expressed the thing that you can do, which is be with this just as this. And that's not nothing. That's Dharma practice. But really important to do it.
May I just say another thing about the self-doubt and the great doubt? This is so good to pull them apart like this, because they're clearly not the same thing. And the, you know, the self-doubt is made up of many, many elements of the mind just telling you terrible stories about yourself. Right? The great doubt, I like to translate that, instead of using the word doubt, which is how it was often translated originally, it's kind of like great wonder, great questioning, great, huh? You know, the, like, what is it? That it's that kind of greatness. And great in the sense of not, this is great, but big, you know, really big. I just don't get it. The world is confusing to me. I want to know, and I don't know. So it's kind of like a great don't know. And self-doubt knows. It's sure. I'm a piece of crap. There's no question.
So, in a sense, self-doubt can give rise to this help me out here.
Desire to investigate. Need.
Investigatory.
Yeah, what an editor.
Yeah, he really did invest.
Of looking, of looking.
Yes.
With
yes.
The mind of great.
Yeah.
Yes.
And
exactly.
Yeah, and practicing great doubt is being willingness to entertain what if this thing that I'm so sure about isn't true in the way I'm sure it is? What if that is not actually the entirety of it? Mm. What if that is the practice of great investigation?
Yeah, it's well said. I wanted to say something about what we call Hwadu practice in Korean Zen, which is, all of these things are very, very close. And they're, I'm in your camp of a person who doubts himself. I mean, it's my specialty on all levels. And there is, on the low energy doubt, self-doubt, and the small kind of doubt, there's this kind of murkiness about it, where you're sure of something. I'll speak for myself. I'm sure of something, but I haven't really seen it, but I'm sure it's true because I feel really shitty. There's that kind of doubt. And in the tradition, one of the practices bringing of great doubt is to bring your, to look at the doubt itself and to bring it into greater focus, like a camera lens that's out of focus on something and it's kind of furry and fuzzy, but actually is, as Josh was saying, to look right at it, and to bring the doubt, the furry doubt, into a greater sense of focus in the camera, and then to use that again to bring that focus into a kind of resolution, and then the doubt becomes the great doubt, a very brilliant kind of a clear not knowing startlingly clear. And I think that's one way of working with it, is one, trusting that you can observe and see, and then to really look it in the face and start to bring this furry doubt into greater focus, and then more than that, to bring it into resolution. Then what is this? Then of course you don't know. There's nothing but that great mind of not knowing manifesting as this and this. So great. We both come from, I think, a Korean background in Zen, and a great reverence for doubt in all of its kind, not to attach to, you know, cynicism, skepticism, and all of that stuff, but to really use it well. Yeah.
And now I've got little furry doubt in my Dharma pack rat. I'm collecting these lovely companion creatures.
It's kind of associating to the furry doubt. You know, at first it seemed like, that's a very sweet little, like a stuffed animal thing. And then I remembered our grizzly bears in our chant. It's kind of scary. Mm. You know, it's kind of, So I don't know if I want to take it back to my nest.
Christine?
I just love crappy armor, so I'm bringing that to mind because I've spent a lifetime wearing crappy armor, and I still put it on a lot. And here, I've gotten the mirror to go, oh, that wasn't even protecting me. And it looks crappy, and I'm the only one who couldn't see it. And it just gives me a sense of humor when I pick it up again. Mm. And it helps me remember, I think it was maybe Sunday night when we first started this, or Monday, and I'm holding in place of that crappy armor that I was staking my life on, is trusting, entrusting that the open heart is its own protection. And I choose that.
Oh, so beautifully expressed. I choose that too.
And it seems that the great doubt too is so intertwined with the facing, that the ability and the courage to face is made possible by the capacity to, maybe this isn't the concrete thing that I think it is, you know. Maybe it's this knot gets a little looser, you know. And because just the facing seems pretty frightening, you know, right? Just being with the, and you know, maybe that is necessary. But then there's this bringing that great doubt with it, that not knowing that, you know, maybe there's some room here for this to loosen up a bit, you know. So the title, you know, the facing, and then bringing in the great doubt. Yeah, they are so intertwined, both of those. Thank you. Okay.
This has all been really lovely. I was just thinking how weirdly preoccupied I get with the stuff that I don't really want to look at directly, you know. That, you know, I know that these bad things are true about me, and I don't want to look at them because I know, you know, that it says something bad about me, and then I spend all my time, you know, sort of believing all this stuff and never really, you know, being willing to take a look at it, you know, and focus on it and see. You know, so what's really here, and why am I so sure? You know, it really seems like this weird sort of certainty. You know, why am I so sure that these things are so terrible about me? You know, and you know, like Diane was saying, we're just, you know, turning and facing them. Seems like that's really the only way to release them, isn't it? Is to take a look at them and see, well. You know, so does a there's a certain truth to them too, right? I mean, there are things that we've done and said and all this stuff, things that we've felt that we wish that, you know, we hadn't felt, and things we've done that we wish we hadn't done, we build them into these solid things that we know that we're bad people because of them, and won't look at them. I think it's not really true, is it? You know, everybody's doing the best that they can in a sense, right? Like I was saying, when Susan was talking, right, about these ancestors that are, you know, like maybe a couple generations back, right? And we look at their positions on things and we go, how could people have thought that, right? How could they have acted in this way that is so obviously wrong, right? But they thought they were doing, you know, according to the times and the environment that they lived in, they thought they were correct, right? And what are people going to think of us two generations down the line? The things that we're so certain are correct, is that even true? How are we so sure of this stuff?
And then amid, this is such a beautiful expression of the practice of great questioning, and amid that, returning to this open, good heart, and meeting this one who is actually only able to do the best that I can. And it's important to do the best that you can. And not the best that you could do if only everything were different. If only you had had more sleep, different parents, and more time. Not that best you could do.
You know, I don't know if I can articulate this, but something you said, Steve, and it has been something I've been looking at a lot recently, the energy that's contained in those self-doubting voices and stories, they're so powerful and energetic. Mm-hmm. And that when we turn away from them, it energizes them more.
Exactly.
It's, and if we fight them, it energizes them. If we buy into them, it energizes them. And of course, we have to be careful not to turn towards them as a technique, mm-hmm. right, with the idea that then they will release. But just this brave turning that Joshua was referring to in his talk, this kind of just, what else is there to do but meet everything as it is, but not with any kind of gaining idea, right? And that seems to, the weird thing is that de-energizes that strong habit mind energy.
It's the only way they could, isn't it?
That's right. Right. It's the only way it could, and if there's a little hint of I'm going to meet things in order to get rid of them, that energizes it too.
Yeah. Right?
So this is such subtle practice to just meet. Just meet.
What I want to go back to what you were saying. I don't know your name.
Net.
So I was really touched by how you expressed your dilemma and challenge. And I think that, and this discussion between great doubt and, you know, self-doubt, which you read, you know, which is kind of evolved. I really appreciate the global existential issues and then the personal existential issues and the interface there. And I so appreciate practice for allowing us to inquire on a global level, but to act really locally, and I mean in real time, in the moment. I don't know if that's making any sense, but
I think the dilemma of the, at least the way I understood the dilemma of the challenge you were facing, was that there's some urgency, it brings in the urgency again of and pressure. And I so appreciate that the teaching, at least in my experience, allows me to stop and pause and just consider this point in time and trust that what emerges in inquiry just at the point in time is maybe, or how I make sense at this point in time from the teachings, or as a guide saying, is enough.
And you're giving a clear expression of your own process of trying to find accord with the teachings. And important for us to not imagine that other people need to be doing it our way. And we can, what a clear window into the way you are meeting this stuff. Thank you.
I appreciate that I was expressing personally, however, and that you're pointing to that. But maybe you could speak to the idea of the global teaching, the larger teaching, and then how that works with being present in the moment.
Well, what I hear and what you're saying, Carolyn, which I really appreciate, is that the place of practice is right in our experience of this moment. And if I'm catching you, what I'm hearing you saying, there these things, faith and doubt, we have these words and this and that, and that the real place of investigation and the real opportunity and gift of our practice is that it's not somewhere else, but right here, and it's what we encounter in the moment, in the specific sensation in the body, the rising of this or the falling or whatever, and that's where the possibility that they're actually not two. It seems like it's global and then particular, mm-hmm. but we really only encounter these global things here, and that's part of the gift of practice, that not theoretical, but in the moment. Is that?
Yes, thank you. Yeah. I thank you for actually articulating, using, you know, getting the right language around that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just...
Yeah, I think that's important, too.
Our Dharma ancestor, Robert Aitken, translates the word koan as universal particular. And this is the exploration, of the universal particular.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.